Blog Talk Radio.
We are the heirs of that first revolution.
Will a strong and united America still be a force for freedom and prosperity around the world?
America has created the longest peacetime economic expansion in our history.
We are the heirs of that first revolution.
Good common sense and sound judgment of the American people and their essential love of justice.
It is Sunday, January 13th, and it's time once again for the Kudzu Vine. This is Tim Shipley coming at you from the mountains of northwest Georgia. Of course, you all noticed immediately that David is not talking to you, and I am. David is going to try to call in. I just got an email from him, maybe by 7:15. He is on his way home from watching our Falcons pull out a victory today. So he should be a happy camper when he does call in. But Catherine Smith down in Atlanta is with us. Good evening, Catherine.
Hello from unseasonably warm Atlanta.
unseasonably warm it is. You know, 2 years ago this time, Catherine, was when we had that ice storm with the snow
right
on top of it, and this area up here was absolutely just paralyzed. And here we are 2 years later, and it's like, I don't know, the tropics or something.
Yeah, I drove by some dogwoods today that were in bloom.
Wow. And we want to give all our folks, if any of you's listening to us riding, please be careful tonight. There's some bad weather headed this way with us, this unseasonably warm stuff, and we'll just keep an eye on it. But in the meantime, we got a show to do. Hopefully David will call in just a minute. We are also expecting about halfway through the show tonight, gentleman from the brand new Harper polling firm, Mr. Brock McCleary, to be calling in, and we look forward to that, from the great state of Pennsylvania. In the meantime, let's talk about some stuff that's going on. And what better place to start than right here in Georgia? And what better place to start right here in Georgia than our old friend, Dr. Phil Gingrey? Of course, we have become accustomed over the years to Dr. Gingrey being just a wee bit on the partisan conservative side, but he has made a speech within the last week that stirred up a lot of stuff. Apparently, Dr. Gingrey gave us a couple of surprises. Catherine, came a little far to the left on the gun control question, saying that perhaps it is a time to talk about things like rapid-fire automatic weapons and about things like large magazines. But on the other hand, then, here he goes the other way, and he says that Todd Akin was partly right when he made those now infamous comments about women being able to shut things down when they're raped to keep from getting pregnant. And he even qualified what he said by saying, and listen, I know I'm a Dr. Catherine. What in the world did you make of that?
You know, it almost makes you speechless, but you know, we're on a radio show, so we have to talk about it. You know, these guys, they just dig themselves deeper and deeper into this stuff. Why did he have to bring it up, first of all?
Yeah.
I mean, what he said is so ridiculous, and it just makes him, it makes him look like an idiot.
Yeah.
As far as the this, you know, shutting the whole thing down. I think his comments on gun control were, you know, were surprising. You know, he talks about limiting access to these large magazines, and that he would be willing to listen to the possibility of, you know, reducing the capacity of those magazines. So I think that's a good, that's good. But why did he, why he spoke in front, and this was at the Chamber of Commerce. It wasn't a Tea Party, you know, powwow.
Mm-hmm.
It was at the Chamber of Commerce. Seems like you might try to temper your remarks to your audience, which I don't,
and
who I don't think are going to buy this, you know, stance on abortion or on race.
Yeah. And you know, I'm sure you've heard since then that Dr. Gingrich said, well, my remarks were misconstrued. So in fairness, I'm going to read exactly word for word what the man said. And in Missouri, Todd Akin was asked by a local news source about rape, and he said, look, in a legitimate rape situation, and what he meant by legitimate rape was just, look, someone can say I was raped, a scared to death 15-year-old that becomes impregnated by her boyfriend, and then has to tell her parents that's pretty tough, and might, on some occasions, say, hey, I was raped. That's what he meant when he said legitimate rape versus non-legitimate rape. I don't find anything so horrible about that. But then he went on and said that in a situation of rape, of a legitimate rape, a woman's body has a way of shutting down so the pregnancy would not occur. He's partly right on that. Now, that's what he said. I don't think anything or anybody misconstrued his comments. To you, Catherine, sounds pretty obvious, don't it?
Yes, it does. It's, you know, that's what he said.
So, I mean, where does he get off trying to say now that, oh, well, everybody, no, did nobody misquote him? He was actually standing there and defending Todd Akin, a guy for who there is no defense for. And, boy, his remarks had gone viral. They are all over the place. They're on the national blogosphere. They're all over the national news. And once again, a Georgia congressman makes news the wrong way. Oh, jeez.
Well,
but
you know,
go ahead.
I'm sorry.
No, I was going to go with the gun thing, but go ahead and say what you've got to say.
Well, if anyone's interested in, you know, speaking out about this, or, you know, participating in the people who are objecting to it, there is a protest tomorrow organized by the Young Democrats of Georgia, and I will tell you.
Right. Steve Golden, right?
Yeah.
Steve Golden sending out the info on it.
At tomorrow at 1 p.m. at Representative Gingrich's Marietta office on Roswell Street in Marietta. So
yeah,
if anybody wants to join
the plan, that red, are they just going to picket the place, or do you know?
Doesn't really say. Hold on, let me see what I can find out. But you can go ahead and I'll see what I find out. But I think that they're just going to pick it or stand in front of the office and wait for him to.
Yeah. Now, if that wasn't enough, then Dr. Gingrich made some jaws drop on the right side of the spectrum when he said, and I quote again, there are some problems, and maybe these huge magazines, even for someone who says, look, I just use an AR-15 for target practice, but do you really need to be standing there shooting at a silhouette, a shot a second, or even quicker with that kind of weapon? For what purpose, Gingrich asked, I would be willing to listen to the possibility of the capacity of a magazine. Okay, And he also went on to say that he's open to revisions of the loophole for gun shows. Again, there can't be no mistake what he was saying, can there?
No.
I mean, this guy apparently is going to be one person on the right side of the spectrum who will be talking to the other side about the possibility of gun control and discussing it, obviously, rationally. Do you think that'll hurt him, Catherine?
I do. Because, I mean, you know, like I've said before, I listen to some of the, you know, talk radio, and they are up in arms about any changes, any restrictions to gun laws, and it's going to be a real hot point issue for these people. And I think Phil Gingrich coming out, Representative Gingrich coming out with these, you know, statements is going to hurt him.
Yeah, well,
I don't know how much. I don't know if it means he'll get primaried or whatever, but I do think that he's going to have some, you know, some people upset with him.
Yeah, well, you know what, Catherine? We're going to get a third opinion on this because David is joining.
Yay.
David, are you there?
Yeah.
Hello. Tell you what, guys. Sorry I'm late. I would have been late either way, but I guess an excuse since the Falcons won, right?
Yeah, really. We have already did a happy dance on here as soon as the show started about that, David. And we also, Catherine and I, just came to the conclusion that Dr. Gingrich's speech made absolutely no one on either side of the political spectrum happy this week. Is that about the way you saw it?
Yeah, if you look at the way he made one set of people mad with one issue and one set with another. And actually, he made, I think, a lot of Republicans mad. Just bring him back up. The abortion comments. I mean, is there
the
some circumstance within, or the rape comments with Todd Akin? Is there some circumstance in which a woman's body could be stressed out during a 30-day ovulation period that it could affect? Sure. But there's plenty of cases where it couldn't either. Why even get into that minutia? Because it's not like you're going to make lots of Americans say, oh, yeah, let's ban abortion in the case of rape, too. I mean, that's not where you start trying to win that argument. I mean, if you're trying to win the argument, you start trying to win it by, okay, let's ban, you know, third trimester abortions. I mean, you know, you start there. You don't start by the hardest core circumstance in which people are pro-choice.
And that's the point, Catherine. The first point you made is the very point Catherine brought up. Why even mention this to start with? Like she said, he wasn't in front of a Tea Party crowd. He was in front of a business crowd. Why even bring it up, right?
It's not going to help that party get back. And I tell you another thing that surprised me. Now, I will say, I read this on a local source. I can't tell you if it was a Georgia source like AJC or Peach Pundit or if it was a Rome source because, of course, he has been the Rome congressman for quite a while, like Hometown Headlines or Rome News Tribune. But I thought, I wonder if this is making news. And then the next thing you know, Politico has this on there. CNN.com has this on here. I mean, if he wanted to get his name in the headlines, he succeeded in doing that.
But, Catherine, why did he do this? What was he thinking?
I don't know. I mean, did he have nothing better to say to the Chamber of Commerce? Couldn't he talk about jobs or about, the fiscal cliff, the Georgia budget? You know, there's like so many other things that would have been more appropriate for that crowd, and to dwell on these two things that. I don't know. I'm surprised by it. It's almost like he had nothing better to talk about, or I don't know.
Yeah. So the bottom line is, you mentioned that conservative radio was just up in arms about his remarks about.
Not about those remarks. But I haven't heard them talk about those remarks. But they have, the only thing they've been talking about for the last 10 days is gun control, and that, you know, the president's coming after your guns, you know, the Democrats hate guns, you know, all this.
And so all of a sudden we have a Republican that says the opposite. My question is to you guys, is this going to hurt Dr. Gingrich politically? You know, he's in a little bit different district than he used to be. And I just wonder. It's a different kind of Republican down there. Go ahead, David.
I really hadn't studied that new district as much. I knew that if he continued to, you know, Cobb, if he continued to have big swaths of Cobb County and South Cobb, and then also had Douglas County, demographics were going to hurt him after a while. As far as, you know, what his new district is, I know it actually stretches almost into Buckhead, if I'm not mistaken. So it seems like that might insulate him a little bit from a Tea Party challenge to the right, but then if he wants to focus more on the abortion side of these comments, that in a certain year, that his district could be more swingable if he doesn't have those really social conservative voters.
So, wait a minute. You're saying that the gun statements he made might actually help him in his
district? I don't know if it'll help him, but if he has more of a suburban Republican instead of an exurban Republican, the gun comments might lend him not to get Tea Partied as fast. I mean, I just don't think that even if you've met up with a bunch of Buckhead Republicans or Marietta City Republicans, I don't think that's the Tea Party's strongest area. I'm sure there's some Tea Partiers everywhere. I'm sure if you went to Manhattan and New York, you'd find Tea Partiers. But I don't know if there's a big enough numbers to Tea Party a congressman in one of those areas. I mean, but I hadn't studied it as closely as I would have been familiar with the old 11th when I was sort of, I wasn't paid to do it, but I was expected to be familiar with the demographics of that district.
Okay, well, we're going to keep an eye on Dr. Gingrich's progress, or lack of it, rather, and see what happens before our guest calls in. We were wanting to swing into another discussion of the state, and I wanted to turn to you, Catherine, because you attended a meeting this week that might shed a little light on what we might look for when the gavel hits and the legislature goes into session tomorrow. Won't you share with us what you have heard?
Sure. I went to the Planned Parenthood kickoff of Women in the Halls, which is their lobbying effort, you know, individual citizen lobbying effort on Thursday night. And Representative and leader and minority leader Stacey Abrams was there, and we were all, you know, what's it going to be, and nobody knows for sure, of course, because there are very few pre-filed bills, so, and they don't usually pre-file the hot stuff anyway, but she thought that it was going to be a little bit easier session as far as social issues go, that they're not expecting any abortion, you know, restricting abortion legislation as of yet. They're not expecting any more immigration issues, though that might come up for some discussion as far as, you know, changing what's already been done. But the big thing's going to be, of course, the budget and the Medicare expansion or Medicaid expansion discussion, and that seems to be the thing that most people are going to be working on, because it affects so many people and it's so much money from the federal government, and everyone's kind of sort of wondering if perhaps Governor Deal will change his mind about accepting that expansion money. So that seems to be what's going to be the focus of most of the, you know, certainly the progressive side of the aisle and the Democrats. But they're not real sure about what the Republicans might be up to. They think that since it's not an election year, they might not do too much to rile people up because they want to wait till they can get some, you know, votes out of it. So that's what Representative Abrams was saying.
Mm-hmm. David, have you heard about any surprises our friends on the other side might be throwing to us?
Well, not really any surprises. I mean, I've seen in the paper, of course, there's the representative from Cartersville, Representative Battles. He wants to arm administrators in schools, and that's his response to the shooting in Newtown. Of course, that seems to be the playbook now for Republicans, is guns, guns, and more guns. It seems like a strange reaction to it. And then I saw just today that new poll came out on the new stadium for Atlanta. Been against, and Nathan Deal apparently, said to Arthur Blank, I don't know that people are going to vote. Legislators of either party are going to be excited to vote for something that has 70% opposition. I mean, we've talked about it before with other pollsters like Tom Jensen that this thing is just not popular. And I know that our guest later, Brock McCleary, he actually did some polling on the Philadelphia Eagles when he talked about Pennsylvania. So it's gotten to be where sports gets polled. That thing, you think it might come up soon, but it might go down soon. And we may see like a Minnesota-type issue where the legislature in Minnesota, they kicked that can down the road for about 10 years. And then, of course, the snow fell in the roof on the Metrodome, and they had to act. But they got 10 more years out of that building in the meantime. So
here's
the point where you get 10 more years out of the existing building.
Here's the problem that they've got. You mentioned the poll that 72% oppose using public funds to build a stadium. Well, that is 5% higher than the previous poll showed in July. So support for this dome being built with public funds is not gaining. It is losing support.
Yeah.
So the question is, some of them had mentioned the possibility of sitting on this thing for a year and trying to garner support for it. But do either of y'all really think this thing is going to look any different a year from now?
No. I tell you what, I was in the building today. That's what's on my mind. I didn't see any paint peeling. I didn't see any cracks in the foundation. Seats were nice. They weren't scratched up. Place didn't smell. All the things that you would think, oh, man, I need a new house. I need a new car. There's problems with my existing one. That facility has no problems. And for most people, that would be a good thing. But, of course, there's a money-making incentive there for Arthur Blank and, I guess, other owners of the Falcons. And that's what he's looking at. He's wanting to get a little bit of money made off of it. Now, it was mentioned to me by somebody I was at the game with, said, in Washington, D.C., or in Maryland, I guess you'd say, in New York and Dallas, they all have new stadiums, and they were completely privately funded, and it cost $1 billion. And if they make $1 billion or $2 billion, then they've made money. And Arthur Blank, I guess, to look at Atlanta and say, can I make more than $1 billion if I build my own building? And if he doesn't think he can make that kind of money, then the government, I guess, has to say, well, is that a project we want to get into if it's not something they can make back its own funds?
Yeah, well, let me throw in a comment on this, and then I want to throw it to Catherine for a question because she's right there in Atlanta and watches Atlanta politics. We know that Mayor Reed and others badly want this stadium built right there near the existing Georgia Dome. It would be a boon for Atlanta. Now, we also know that if Arthur Blanks has to go and privately build this thing, he's probably going to move it perhaps out of the city of Atlanta into the suburbs somewhere where property is cheaper and where he can build an open-air facility, and in the process, you might lose some things that would have come to Atlanta, and it would be competing with the Georgia Dome for any business that could be done outside as well as inside. So, Catherine, what are the politics of this thing like in the city? Is this going to be one of those things where residents of the city of Atlanta are going to support it more than, say, people, up mine in David's way, or what's going on there?
Well, I think, I haven't heard anything, sort of an ordinary conversation about this, but I think that if Arthur Blank, he knows better than I do, but it seems to me that if he wants to build, if he ends up deciding to build a stadium, then it's going to be in his best interest for it to be in Atlanta, or at least close to Atlanta, downtown, because if you're looking to fill that arena outside of football season, if it's out in some, far away from MARTA and everything else, it's going to be a hard sell, especially if you've already got the dome, if you've still got the dome there. So mm-hmm. that seems like, if he's got to use it as an income generating prospect, then he's going to need to have it, close to downtown and not have the dome there, it seems to me. I think one of the things that is coming up in conversation a lot is the development of the area around the proposed location of the new dome, which is a pretty rough neighborhood. A lot of foreclosed properties, I don't know if there's a lot of crime, but I suspect there is. And I think there's a lot of people who think that, this is an opportunity to improve the neighborhood as well and provide a more interesting environment for a stadium, with restaurants and other activities around the stadium, which they said they were going to do that with that neighborhood before, and they never did. So mm-hmm. I think that's the big concern of Atlanta residents is that, you're going to build a big dome here, but we need you to, think about the surrounding neighborhood as well. And that's, I think, the thing that is most compelling
okay,
to
David,
Atlanta residents.
Yeah, David, you're Mr. Atlanta Falcon among us three, let's be honest. You know as much about that thing. Dude, you ought to write a book. I'm serious. But anyway, what does your gut tell you here about Arthur Blank? If it's thrown into his lap, what are his realistic options? Could he realistically raise the funds himself to build a stadium right beside the Georgia Dome?
I think what he pretty much has to do is he has to do whatever has to be done has to make the dome obsolete. If he builds it right down there, then he could then, whether he privately finances it or gets partial financing from the government, he can then get them to tear down the existing dome. And he needs that because I'll tell you what, I would be willing to bet that if he built an open-air stadium, be it in the suburbs or not, but just in the suburbs, and the Georgia High School Association has to choose between his stadium and the dome, they would choose the dome. I really believe that. It would just, and also if it's a grass field, then he may not even want the high school playing there. The SEC has already said they're staying with a dome stadium. They have no real interest mm-hmm. in being in the open air stadium and a grass field. And there's other things like that. I mean, a Final Four basketball tournament cannot take place, in an open air stadium. I mean, you could be looking at a facility for 10 games a year guaranteed, and that would be about it. I'm sure he could find some little summer concert. The MLS will be a big, thing for him to at least sell some seats, although they draw around 27,000, so it wouldn't be the kind of income you get from NFL football, but it's mm-hmm. something to justify the thing. So I think those are all factors, and it'd be interesting to see.
If his options are not that good, then, as you seem to indicate, then we turn our attention again to the government and the state legislature in particular, who is staring right down the barrel of passing a bill to allow the city of Atlanta to tax, I believe, hotel bills and things like that, a hotel tax. And then we're talking about $300 million. Can they really do that?
Yes, I mean, that's the key component, the taxation bill. And this would be a Republican-led legislature voting for a, you know, tax increase. And, of course, anytime we, as we know, people, you know, raise fishing licenses by a dollar.
Yeah.
Anything they do, it gets counted as a tax increase. And this would be a straight-out, we all agree, tax increase.
And David, on that point, I'm going to ask you to hold that note right there, and we'll continue this discussion later. But I believe our guest has joined us, if you'd like to welcome him in.
Yes, I'd like to welcome Brock McCleary. Welcome, Brock.
Hi, how are you?
Yes, well, Brock, we have read a lot about you, and we're so excited to get you on the show because, like I think I told you, we've had other pollsters, we've had other Republicans, but somebody of your stature and polling on the Republican side, that's something we've never had on the Kudzu Vote, so we're real excited. So why don't, first off, tell a little bit the people about your background.
Yeah, sure, and thanks for having me on. I certainly appreciate the opportunity. My background in politics is pretty, I would say it's pretty diverse. I mean, I have had many of the jobs and that, you know, that most political operatives would have, you know, throughout the course of their career. I've been an ad maker, you know, for Republican campaigns. I was a communications director. I worked for Patrick McHenry from North Carolina, well-known Southern conservative. You know, I worked on K Street doing advocacy campaigns, and I was, for the last 4 years, I was a party strategist for the NRCC, which, for anyone who may not know, essentially the NRCC is the political arm of House Republicans.
Yes. You know, people listen to our show, they follow politics just a little bit closer. I mean, if you're downloading political podcasts, it's just not a passing thing, but that's quite a background. Now, you started Harper Polling, and you started, I guess, right after the election. You can tell us about it, and you can tell us why you started it.
Yeah, let me give you the genesis of it. So in the 2010 cycle, when Republicans picked up 63 seats, you know, we were getting, you know, several polls a day coming in across the country and tracking House races and trying to figure out where to spend money and help Republican candidates. You know, and I looked and I just said, we don't have the capacity to analyze all of this polling that's coming in. We're taking a passing look and moving on to the next one and then, you know, going on and making decisions. And I just thought that's really not the best use of you know, the money that's being spent on the polling or the information that you're essentially leaving on the shelf because you're not, you know, you're not giving it a good look. So fortunately, though, the wave was so good in 2010 that, you know, if you essentially got your boat out there in the ocean when the wave came, you got swept in. And you know, however, you know, we go into the next cycle, and one of the things I determined is I wasn't going to let that happen again. So as the deputy political director, I took on the job of being the polling director and essentially rebuilding a polling department that had ceased to exist. And, you know, the NRCC's polling department had some good years. Some well-known Republican pollsters like Glenn Bolger had held the position. And so we built this internal system to be able to analyze all of the data and do so in a very clear and quick, coherent way. And then we started running across campaigns and other political groups who were using IVR technology for their polling, and we said, well, we should be using that too. We knew that it was affordable. We're still learning what its best uses were. And so we essentially started doing in-house polling using IVR technology, and we had certainly seen what PPP, Public Policy Polling, is a well-known Democratic IVR polling firm, and according to many, probably the most accurate pollster in the country, at least this past election cycle. And so, you know, kind of knew that there was a model like that out there. So, you know, we got through the cycle. I think we built a nice department. We've got, you know, really a living, breathing polling department that I leave behind there. But the IVR side of that, I have, you know, gone out and started my own IVR polling firm. You know, some call it, you know, the contrast to PPP, and I don't necessarily, you know, run from that characterization because they've built quite a thing there. Even if they are of the other party, I'm willing to admit that they've got an impressive operation. And so, you know, I think we try to be a little bit different, though, in that I think the questions that we ask, I think, are a little different than what other people are doing out there. And I think to some degree it's a creative process to try to find questions that are different than the rest. And sometimes that's not as hard as it may sound because polling has become very, what I call, formulaic. You know, you'll see 10 polls in a week and all 10 will ask the same five questions. And so you just get a redundancy of all this stuff that we already knew. And so trying to find the new question, the interesting angle is kind of what we're doing. And I think, you know, if you look at our website, harperpolling.com, you see that the analysis that goes into the polls that we do is a little different than probably what you're accustomed to. Most of it is just putting in paragraph form what you could read for yourself in the top lines. But I think we give some entertainment, some interesting analysis, some insight, some candor about the questions and why we asked them and why the way we asked them we did. And so, you know, I think we're doing something different out there. It's very exciting. The reception has been really great. And I tell you, I think we're at a place where we're going to start growing quicker than I had anticipated.
Yeah, you talked about interesting questions. I think my favorite was, who would win a fist fight between Mitt Romney and Barack Obama? I don't know why I came up with that question. Did you see any crazier than that one this cycle?
You know, I'll tell you, I will give due credit to PPP. They asked a question last week that was obviously meant to kind of poke at the Republican-led House of Representatives, but I think it asked a question like, what would you find, you know, what do you dislike most, head lice or Congress? And I think head lice won. And so, you know, it's a nonsensical, silly kind of thing. But I think to their credit, it makes a point. It's a poll that's clever, and I think, you know, helps reinforce the kind of motivation that exists there from a partisan perspective. They want to point out that the Republican Congress is unpopular. The Democratic Congress before that was unpopular, and the Republican Congress before that was unpopular. We're kind of living in a period of unpopularity, you know, pretty much across the board with politics.
Yes, well, I'll go ahead and tell you, Brock, I may be a huge Democrat, but if you gave me the choice between having head lice and having a half dozen Republican congressmen over for dinner, I'll go ahead and have the dinner. I have no interest in head lice. Maybe Tim and Catherine feel differently, but that's just me. But speaking of Catherine and Tim, I'm going to pass along for them for some questions. They may come back to me. Catherine, you're welcome to ask anything we've kind of brought for.
Well, I wanted to just ask there was a lot of conflicting polling during the 2012 general election, and do you have any thoughts on what caused that, or, you know, explanations for why it was that way?
Yeah, you sure, you bet I do. So I would, I've spent a lot of time in the weeks since the election trying to make sense of what was the difference between Republican polling and Democratic polling. You know, and listen, both sides had their problems, but I think it's more pronounced on the Republican side, particularly, you know, polling the presidential race. What I can tell you, having been a part of the Republican polling community last cycle, is that I think we started with too many assumptions. Too many assumptions, most notably about the composition of the electorate, what the electorate would look like on November 7th of 2012. And in our heads, we said, you know, in 2008, Barack Obama got elected in one of the biggest, it's a landslide by modern, you know, in a modern perspective. And he, you know, Republicans were depressed. They stayed at home. Democrat turnout was tremendous. 2008 was a high water mark for Democrats, is what we told ourselves. And then 2010, of course, we come back and flip the whole thing on its head, and we're still, you know, still feeling some of the, you know, some of the, you know, the joy of that, and feeling like the political environment was still looking as much like 2010 as it was 2008. So we said 2008 could not be replicated, and that was the big calculation. And so, you know, what you have to understand about polling is, every poll is weighted, meaning that every poll is, you get the raw data and you increase in certain areas and decrease in certain areas to get a demographic that looks right. Demographic meaning, what's your breakdown of Republican, Democrat, Independent? What's your breakdown of men to women? What's your breakdown of, you know, white, non-white? And so Republican polls are being weighted to a scenario that looked something like 2004. Democrats were weighting their polls to 2008 because they were believing the whole time that we can do 2008 again. We know the president isn't unpopular, but we've got this plan, and we, you know, they do all this data mining and this modeling and this extraordinarily advanced stuff that no one has ever done, and we may never be replicated again. And we think it's 2008. Well, on election day, they were right. It looked like 2008 in many respects. And I think it was the same story. Republicans still just, there was a enthusiasm problem among Republicans. And you could probably spend a lot of time trying to figure out what or why that was. But, you know, and Democrats were, they were enthused. Young voters remain enthused. African-American voters remain enthused. Hispanic voters remain enthused. And they helped drive turnout among those key groups, and really they helped shape the electorate. That in a nutshell is why their polling looked more right than ours last cycle.
Thank you. That was actually my only question. I'm going to go ahead and pass it back to Tim.
Well, good evening, by the way, Mr. McCleary. Thank you for being with us tonight. I wanted to ask kind of a follow-up to what Catherine was asking. We have a lot of conservative listeners on our show here. And those that I've talked to just about universally feel burned, shall we say, by, you know, the polling they followed before the election. They believed, you know, I'm not going to call any names, but you know the gold standards of some of the polls that conservatives mm-hmm. follow, and plus the internal polls that were being leaked from the campaign, and they really felt burned to the point that they don't know whether to believe any pollsters or not. Yeah. What could you say to those listeners about why you might be different?
What I would say to them is remain skeptical. I think people who are interested in politics and follow polling should remain eternally skeptical, because there is a hard science to it and there is an art to it. The art is a lot about what I just discussed, trying to figure out what it's going to look like, trying to make those projections, which are, you know, which are incredibly hard. I mean, I think that the failures of all of that, I think that will make polling more transparent and more accountable by having people who remain skeptical. And so I don't actually want to, what I think makes us different is that I talk a lot about who we called. And I talk a lot about, you know, when I weight a survey and I'm getting a, you know, a ratio of men to women, or, you know, 18 to 29 year olds to seniors, whatever my ratio is, I sort of discuss candidly why that is. You know, there's a model I'm putting forward. Hey, I don't know, maybe mine's right or mine's wrong. I think this is the best projection that any pollster could make at this time. So I think, for me, being transparent and being conversational about what polling is, I hope makes me a little different. I mean, believe me, that was not the norm. I think at the NRCC, we did a lot of good for public polling and political polling in that we were always asking questions and looking at, wanted to look at data that was weighted and unweighted in different ways. I mean, that had become, those conversations about weighting and things like that had never really been had. It was almost like a dirty little secret. Now it's no longer a dirty little secret. We talk about it a lot, and I think the more that people talk about it, the conversation is really, really helpful, and I hope that I'm, you know, hoping to, that I'm moving that conversation along.
And funny you should mention the word weighting, because my next question was going to be about that very thing. I noticed on your site in a poll where you polled purely GOP voters that almost half of your sample was from the age group of seniors over the age of 65. So is the GOP typical voter getting older, or did you oversample that age group for some reason?
That's a great question. I'm glad that you picked up on that. I do, in the poll analysis, I do draw attention to it, and I think I actually have a snarky line at the end that says something like, yes, it's true that it's 50%, you know, that the Republican, your average Republican primary voter is most likely to be older than 66 and white. Because essentially where we started from is we went and see if I make this fairly simple. The people that we called, the determined characteristics of a group of people that we were going to call were people who had really voted in Republican primaries. You can bet that they come out on a pretty consistent basis. So then what we did is we just weighted the results, which they came in very, very close to the total, that total universe of people. That total universe of people is just about 50% are over 66 years old. And so it's hard data. It's real. And it's, you know, it's certainly something that I think that the Republican Party needs to have a conversation about.
Wow. That's amazing. Okay. Well, thank you, sir, for that. And I'm going to turn it back to David for some more questions.
Sure. Well, Brock, you've released two polls thus far. One was a national poll in December, and then you just released a Pennsylvania poll in the last, I guess, week. The national poll you did, and of course it's, you know, more recent than the election, were there any results out of that that you're like, wow, that's surprising given the 2012 election, or is it just kind of what you expected a few weeks after the real thing happened?
Yeah, no, I think that I was surprised by a couple of things. First thing was, you know, we fielded that survey right as the fiscal cliff vote was approaching, and I was kind of talking to one benefit of having served in the party for as long as I have. I know a lot of people, and so I can find out what's on the mind of lawmakers who are trying to make a tough decision pretty quickly with a phone call. And so one of the things that obviously I was hearing from talking to people is the Norquist Pledge, the Grover Norquist Pledge, no new taxes, you know, was made them fearful that breaking that pledge could bring consequences in a primary. And so what I wanted to do is find out, you know, these are people who would show up in a Republican primary. So these are the people to be afraid of if you're going to be afraid of them, of anyone. The pledge really did not come out particularly strong. I mean, at 47%. Now, I would have thought that number would be, you know, would be higher. But I think in explaining why that pledge number did not come in as big as I would have thought it is, I think it's because essentially, you know, I think the president has outfoxed the Republican Party in messaging, you know, all this issue about, you know, revenues and tax increases. The president has done a good job of making the sum total of the Republican tax message that we want to protect rich people from paying more taxes. That's not, for me as a Republican, that's not my tax reform agenda. But that's what I think voters have come to associate as the tax plan of Republicans, is just to protect the rich. And that can't be the economic message of this party. And so I think that's why the pledge doesn't come in as strongly as it probably did 5-10 years ago, is because people are saying, well, that probably just means that he isn't going to vote to, you know, raise taxes on bazillionaires. So that was, you know, that was a big thing. I'll give you one quick other thing. I asked whether compromise was essentially a dirty word, you know, whether you think that when people in politics compromise, it's better or worse for the country. Better came in at 66%, to worse was 19%. I mean, again, we're talking to base Republican primary voters here. And compromise seems to be something that they think is all in all is better for the country.
Yeah, I mean, I guess that's more hopeful for those Republicans that want to seek moderation at times instead of, just being so fearful of being Tea Party. We spoke about Representative Gingrey at the top of the show and kind of the dynamic he found himself in it this week. Well, you did a Pennsylvania poll. First off, why did you choose Pennsylvania? Is that where you're from, or is there a reason that that was the
that is state? That is my home state. Yes, my wife and young daughter and I just recently moved back to Pennsylvania after being in Washington for six years, and so we are putting an extra emphasis on our home state. And I just kind of know the place well. I've been working, with the Pennsylvania Congressional Delegation for 4 years. We've elected 5 new Republican congressmen from Pennsylvania in the last 2 cycles. And so, I'm just kind of acutely interested in what's going on in the state. And, between Penn State and some of the other big voter ID law, there's some big issues happening there that I think are interesting to follow.
Yes. Well, I'm going to change. We're going to get a little Pennsylvania politics, even though we're mainly a Southern politics show. But you actually, like some of the other companies that do automated polling, you asked some other questions, including convenience stores and about Andy Reid. And I know they talked about firing her. Should they keep him or fire him? And for those not familiar, Andy Reid is a very large man that looks like he could have health issues from his weight. He also has very troubled children. Did you think about asking whether or not Philadelphia citizens or Pennsylvania citizens, if they thought that Andy Reid should take a year off to work on his family dynamics and his health? Because me living many states away and not being a fan of the Philadelphia Eagles, I still am concerned for the man. I think he should have not taken that job, and he should have worked on himself and then maybe some with his family.
You raise an interesting point. I guess many were surprised that he took a job as quickly as he is. I think that the man loves to coach football. As far as people's personal life, I mean, I think from a professional standpoint, I don't think we want to veer into the into anything that's seen as a commentary. I tend to mind my own business and like it when others mind theirs, and maybe that's just my nature. Maybe that's just my nature. I don't know, but I do think that that the Philly sports fans are some of the most rabid you'll ever meet, and I lived there for a couple of years, and I know that any time there's a controversy in Philly sports, man, the city is just enthralled. And so I wanted to go and take a look and see if in the aftermath they were satisfied that they let the winningest coach in franchise history walk away.
Yeah, well, I guess that's just the biggest loser watch here in me. I just thought, man, this would be the perfect year to collect a salary and take 1 year off and get your house in order. But, once again, I will admit I'm butting into this business, but hey, that's what I do.
I would have gone on vacation for a year. If I were you, I'm like you, I would have gone on vacation for a year. I would have taken a little break. That seems like a hard job.
Yeah. And not vacation, but the old Covey, sharpen the saw. I mean,
there
he probably would have come back a better coach just because he would have had some time to recharge. Well, let's get to that. Let's get to the politics. I don't know that many people outside the other 49 states are going to be that interested in the convenience stores, although people in Pennsylvania probably thought that was really informative. Politically, what are some of the findings about Pennsylvania that you found?
Well, I think there are two interesting things. We asked people what was the biggest story in the state last year, because I think our assumption at the start was that Penn State would be the big issue. And it really did. I mean, there are some pretty important things going on here. We are Marcellus Shale in Pennsylvania is creating a boom in natural gas, and just wealth being created rapidly throughout the state. And lots of big things with Penn State came in overwhelming. I mean, it is an issue that is having an impact in every aspect of the state's politics. And so, for those who you know, aren't from the States, but you certainly know the story. You're as horrified as anyone else by the story. And you can imagine that, you know, the kind of impact that it has, you know, all throughout the state, particularly in politics. So it's really kind of a hot issue there. The other thing is public pension reform. I mean, there was a reform that's coming at the state level. We saw that, you know, what Scott Walker did in Wisconsin and even Democrats like Mario Cuomo in New York are going through public sector pension reform issues. It's a big fight, but it has big political stakes. John Kasich in Ohio is undertaking it, and I think Tom Corbett in Pennsylvania is giving it a look. And it's, you know, what we did is we kind of looked at the two competing messages on the issue, and that's one of the things that we like to try to do is look at the way that the issues are being communicated by both sides and figure out who's got an advantage and who doesn't. So that's not necessarily a referendum on the issue, but who's doing a better job, because at the end of the day, the best idea needs to be sold. And it came out dead even in Pennsylvania that, you know, some people seem to support the message that the state can't afford the pension benefits that it gave out in the 90s, and you know, now everyone's got to sacrifice a little bit. And the other side being that, you know, hey, you guys gambled away that money on Wall Street during the financial crisis, and we should not have to pay the price. And so that comes out dead even, and that's a really big issue that's happening in states all throughout the country, is trying to get their budgets depend on getting their pension reform measures in place.
Yes. Well, Brock, just an overall question. You've had these two polls. What's next? I mean, you can tell us what frequency you think you'll come out with polls throughout 2013, if there's any states that you're looking more at. Just tell us what the future is.
Yeah, sure. Now, we are, I think we'll be releasing another survey this week. You know, I think that there are some interesting races that are starting to at least be rumored across the country that we may be looking at. But, you know, I think in the aftermath of the fiscal cliff, I think the guys in Washington are you know, got their sights set on what's coming with the debt limit and debt limit increase and the sequester. And I think, you know, just as the fiscal cliff presented a quandary for many, I think this is going to as well. And so we may begin to look at, you know, what are the issues that are playing out there as the fight gears up. And then, you know, I can assure you that we'll have a screwy question or two that, you know, you'll probably find interesting, but will not be of any real great consequence to our society. So we always try to get one or two of those as well.
Yes. Well, since we've already established that I don't mind butting in anybody's business, Brock, anytime you're in question about what state to look at, in the next 2 years, I think South Carolina is going to be one of the most fascinating states to follow, with two Senate races and a governor's race. So I don't think you can ever go wrong poll on them.
No, in fact, you're very, very right. I think that's a state we're looking at, you know, that's going to be kind of present a wealth of opportunities. You know, it's obviously, having worked with House Republicans, I know that first district seat is open, and former Governor Sanford is taking a hard look, and that's, of course, you know, going to be an interesting special election. And special elections and runoffs are always weird things. So, you know, I think that state's going to have a bevy of political storylines over the next 2 years.
Well, Brock, I hope you've had as much fun as we have, because we want to have you back on once some more polls get out there and have you discuss those on the Kudzu Vine.
Yeah, I'm happy to do it, guys. I enjoyed my time with you here. Let me know, and I'll certainly get back to talk with you.
Great. Thank you very much.
Thank you, sir.
Take care. Have a good evening.
Good night.
And you. Well, one more thing before we close this out. And, Tim, I'm not in front of the board like you are, but I think we got just a minute. Jay Rockefeller announced his retirement. First, Tim, were you surprised? And second, what do you think our chances are holding that seat?
Not really a surprise. His approval rating was way down. He's 75 years old. Representative Shelley Moore Caputo is running for the seat. And I think the GOP could pick that seat up, David.
Yeah. Catherine, your thoughts?
So do I. I think it's going to be a battle. We need to fight for it.
Yeah,
I mean, they're going to have to come up with the right candidate. Obviously, Joe Manchin and Earl Ray Tomlin have run and won in a state that at the presidential level has just – it's no state's probably gone faster and harder Republican than West Virginia has in the past 8 years, or
right.
I guess 5 years, six. Because I'm not sure if Kerry, I don't know if the decline started with Kerry or if it started with President Obama, but it is definitely with his weakest states. So they're going to have to find that right candidate, because that's one where you think, well, probably Rockefeller pulls it out if he runs, and now that's a seat that you have to defend. It's kind of like the first move of 2014 is a negative for Democrats, whereas they seem to catch every break in 2012 and being able to hold the Senate. So that's one we'll definitely discuss more. Maybe we'll get some good polling on it as well as that race
yeah.
unfolds. Yeah. Well, Tim, if you'll hit the music when you're ready, I won't be here with you next week because, of course, if I'm watching that game till nearly 7 o'clock, there's no way, but I'm going to try to get y'all a great guest host to take my place.
Okay. Well, good night,
okay.
guys.
Good night. Thanks, guys.
We are the heirs of that first revolution.
Will a strong and united America still be a force for freedom and prosperity around the world?
America has created the longest peacetime economic expansion in our history.
We are the heirs of that first revolution.
Good common sense and sound judgment of the American people and their essential love.